With KWBU News in Waco, I'm Rylan Barton. This month we're taking a look at poverty in Waco. About 30% of Wacoans live below the poverty line. That's about double the state's poverty rate. And Waco's median household income is about $32,000 a year. That's about $20,000 less than families make on average across Texas. City leaders are well aware of these stats, and last year the city commissioned the Upjohn Institute, a think tank that researches the causes of unemployment, to report on Waco's economy and employment trends. Those findings are guiding the city's poverty initiative, Prosper Waco. I sat down with Waco Mayor Malcolm Duncan Jr. and former Mayor Virginia Dupuy, who are heading up Prosper Waco. I'm Rylan Barton. I'm here with Mayor Malcolm Duncan and former Mayor Virginia Dupuy. We're going to be talking about poverty and underemployment in Waco and how the community is trying to respond to these issues. Just to start off, I'd like to put some stats out there. About 30% of Wacoans are below the poverty level. That's compared to about 17.4% statewide. So what's going on here? Why is there such a big difference between Waco and the rest of the state?
Well, I think there's several different factors. I think one of the things we found out in the Upjohn work and looking at some other outside data is that large student populations have an effect, but you certainly can't explain the 17 versus 30% with students. I mean, you know what's out here.
And just to be clear, the Upjohn study, this is a study that was commissioned by the city last year. Right. And it focused on labor and unemployment.
Waco. What we asked Upjohn was to create a strategic plan for economic development for people in poverty, mm-hmm. whereas we'd always engaged in economic development to raise higher-level wage jobs, to recruit higher-level, higher-paying jobs to the city. We're now going to focus the city's economic development efforts on more engaging and employing our underemployed and unemployed mm-hmm. community.
Yeah. So that brings me to my next question. So businesses need to make money, but that objective might not always align with hiring more employees or paying them more. So what needs to happen to kind of encourage members of the business community to hire more?
I think that there's got to be a lot of conversation, first of all. It doesn't make economic sense for a business to just hire more employees. There's got to be something that they can do that customers want to buy. Businesses are focused on serving their customers and finding good people who can deliver those services. That's kind of the mindset. And then as they make more money, they're able to expand and provide more services, so that just hiring more people is not necessarily something businesses are considering unless there's an internal need for more employees. So, and of course, businesses are going to do everything they can to keep and grow the employees that they have. But they do, as they grow, they do need to, you know, bring in more good people. That's kind of how a business thinks. They're very externally focused on their customers. That's who they serve. And then they manage the system, and they need employees. But I think that one of the things that we're learning is that businesses, we need to be in closer communication with businesses. We have been on just looking at their needs, but I don't know that we've had enough conversations yet about, okay, how is poverty impacting the overall economy? What's happening there, and what can businesses do that makes sense for their business model, but at the same time makes sense for community, for citizens? We need to somehow build ladders even within the businesses.
And those, I think, one of the things that Upjohn told us in the very beginning was that businesses will participate if they can see a return on their investment. Mm-hmm. And Upjohn gave us they did a lot of research with local employers and people that are unemployed or underemployed, and the soft skills issue came up time and time again. There's showing up for work on time, how you dress, being able to fill out a resume, an application, just normal daily discipline is missing in a lot of these hard-to-engage folks. And so the more we talk to employers, the more we learned that some of our larger employers with significant quantities of, you know, entry-level jobs have 30% and 40% turnover, which is a huge cost. So they can see if we can provide some means of the job training, soft skills development for this population that we're trying to reach, it will deliver return on investment for those businesses.
And that in turn gives hope to the people who are having difficulty. Right. You know, hope is really about having having a dream, something you want to do, and then seeing how you can get there. And we need to provide ladders for people to be able to get there.
And that's something we've never really prioritized in our development or recruitment, is that we have so many educational resources to provide for employers if they will provide an upward ladder for their employees. We have some large employers that will hire large quantities of entry-level folks but then not provide an opportunity to graduate. If we can somehow or another bring in more employers, more diverse industries that have upward mobility within their ranks, we have the resources to train those people.
Mm-hmm. One thing that the Upjohn study also mentioned was that the job chain. So workers move up the career ladder, but a lot of times, if there's an opening, a job opening, I guess especially in a higher paid job, that job might be filled by somebody from out of town, presumably, and so that might end up, might mess up the job ladder. So if somebody comes in from out of the bubble, that person below him doesn't advance up to that next level. Do you think that that's something that ends up happening a lot in Waco? That it's
I think it could, but just think about if you're not on the ladder. I mean, look at the high significant number of people 16 to 24 that aren't participating in the labor force at all. Mm-hmm. So if you're not on the ladder, there's no opportunity for advancement. So our goal is to get them on the ladder. And we think there will be opportunities where there's not this need to draw in outside mm-hmm. talent, because we'll be developing talent here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and there are as you mentioned, there are programs to help work on those soft skills, even something down to building a resume. I mean, can you describe what some of those programs are like?
Well, some of those are, of course, in the process of being developed. There's some that already exist, but I think as the city as a whole has not looked at those collectively to see where maybe some of the gaps and some of those training opportunities are. One of the challenges, we really do have everything we need in this community to develop what needs to happen. It's just pulling them together to make those plans, develop those plans, and then implement them. That's where, of course, the collective impact model has become the model that we are currently working on. We're developing started out as the Greater Waco Collective Impact Initiative that is now more appropriately called Prosper Waco. But that's about pulling together the issues relative to education, what education is need, pulling together the education partners that we have. It's about financial security of families, which is what we've been talking about and what the main subject of this this discussion today. But we've got to have that education. It leads right into that. Another dimension is health. And so Prosper Waco is working on all three and putting together the kind of teams to address some of these issues. It is so complex and so deep. If there are just not any quick, easy answers, but we've got some of the best minds, some of the best hearts, the best foot soldiers in this city stepping up to the plate to put that whole system together.
So you're mentioning this collective impact study. Can you help break that down for me? I know that, like you say, now you're using Prosper Waco. It's got a really lovely ring to it instead of the Greater Waco.
GWCII.
The GWCII. It rolls off the tongue.
Does sound better.
So the idea of this is that you're trying to unite a whole bunch of different stakeholders or a whole bunch of different people focusing on a whole bunch of different problems in Waco. How does that work? You mentioned a backbone. What is this backbone structure?
Okay, well, now a backbone is a piece of the whole structure. The backbone is essentially the staff that works to hold everything together. You have to have some staff members who are dedicated to getting this whole body of work done, and they support the community efforts as we move forward in developing particular programs that will be targeted. We can't do everything. We've already, as a community, been doing a little bit of everything. We have wonderful social services, Caritas, and if I start naming a few, they just, the list goes on and on. There's so many good people, what we call implementing partners, stakeholders who are already doing good work. But the backbone is charged with pulling all of that together. But one of their primary jobs is going to be keeping metrics. The goals that will be set must have metrics behind them. And I really should turn this over to Malcolm Duncan, because this has been his mantra. This is what he's been working on. Whatever we do, we've got to be able to measure and stay focused on moving those metrics so that we start changing some of the statistics that you quoted earlier in the in the program.
Well, I think we've got this chart that a consultant brought to us. FSG Group brought us some great ideas on how to form a collective impact and how they work and what the keys to making them work are. And there's five critical functions that a backbone has to provide. And one of them is you've got to have a common agenda. The whole community needs to share in the belief that this is in our best interest, that we all will work together. One of the things I love remembering is Judge Starr talking about the high degree of social capital in Waco. When he came to Waco, he was just amazed at how many people cared about doing something to make this a better place to live. So we see Prosper Waco as the key to drawing all of this social together, harnessing this social capital together to work on the common good. But the shared common agenda, you've got to have measured results. You've got to have constant communication. I mean, we've got what I think Virginia alluded to is over 600 nonprofits engaged in some form of this work in this community. And if we keep doing things the way we've always done them, we'll get the same results. So we see Prosper Waco as the real, the collective collaborative that draws all these efforts together, focused on the three areas that Virginia mentioned.
And so how will this collective end up nailing down concrete goals for, and concrete projects, I guess, for the city?
Well, we've been working on that. I think the we've identified either two or three goals under each of those areas that are major goals.
But there'll be a steering committee formed in each of the areas, in health, education, and financial security.
And those steering committees will be the ones who will actually decide on what those goals are. The board is offering that to them, but they're the ones who've got to
work out the strategies. I mean, one of our primary goals for financial security is completion of post-secondary education. And there's so many different avenues to attack that on that you can't just have one strategy. So the steering committee will be developing the different components of that. If you look at the county right now, 1 in 10 economically disadvantaged students that graduate from high school complete a post-secondary degree or a certificate. If we can double that, that doesn't seem that hard to make that 20% instead of 10%, it will have a significant impact on their standard of living and the quality of life in the community.
So before there was this this iteration of Prosper Waco, Prosper Waco was just focused on poverty, and then there's the Greater Waco Education Alliance.
Yes.
And you guys have said that you ended up finding yourselves running into each other a lot. Virginia, you ran the Education Alliance. So can you talk a little bit about how education and I guess just raising a child and teaching a child, how does this end up fitting into these issues?
Well, for one thing, every year another class of students across the whole community graduates. You've got new young people either going on for some form of higher education or entering into the job market. In other words, there's a constant wave of young people feeding into the community. They've got to be prepared. And there are a number of ways, there are a number of factors that enter into their decision making. But the education system is necessarily at this point, because of a lot of state required mandates, more or less, mm-hmm. for the school systems. They're focused on graduation. Well, graduation. Well, that's good, except that you also need young people to be thinking toward a career, not just graduation. But our school systems are overburdened with the ability to do both. They've just got to focus on getting students graduate. That's what the state is expecting. Now, House Bill 5 did help in that they are now asking the schools to help them go on a particular career path. I won't say a career path, just a course of studies, so that they are fully prepared. But the schools need help in terms of community support of that. So I won't get into all of the ways that we'll get there.
Real quick, just to be clear, the House Bill 5, this is something that passed through the Texas legislature last year, and it changed some of the education requirements in high school
for kids. Yes, that's correct.
And also it gave different diploma options that were career-focused.
And it allowed for much greater collaboration with our community college and TSTC in terms of programs, you know, that you can offer educational opportunities within high school level for dual credit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think something to just add on to what Virginia's saying, and I don't think she takes enough credit for it, the Education Alliance raised the community awareness of the critical importance of education and that it can't start in high school. Mm-hmm. I mean, this one of the primary goals of the education group is every child arrives at school ready to learn. Well, that's in kindergarten. There's a tremendous need for mentoring, for parent skills, for even getting into the Healthy Baby Initiative that the Waco Foundation has sponsored. You can't wait until they get to school to start affecting this culture.
Right, yes. And that's one thing I really want to talk to you about. What can the community do to help make a better system for children who live in poor communities?
Well, I'll focus first just on arriving at school ready to learn. At kindergarten, now across the state, all the schools in our particular ISDs have agreed to come up with the same way of measuring that when children come in, how ready are they? That way we can know when children arrive, are they really ready to start learning? Or are they already behind? There are many children, particularly in families who don't have the means, who are working two or three jobs, just trying to keep food on the table. They've not been talking with their children, have been reading to their children. They've not been able to do a lot of things that other families can. So that's where we bump in, we bump into the financial security issues. But nonetheless, there are there's one model that I'm looking at very seriously right now and hoping that we'll be able to do this for the whole county. There are just some videos available, short videos available that are educationally sound that every parent could, if we get this system. And I'm getting ahead of myself in terms of talking about some specifics, but there are some programs, some means of helping parents in very, very simple ways prepare their children so that when they come to kindergarten and they go through this assessment, they can be there with flying colors. That's our goal. We want our children to arrive well-fed, and, of course, we get into sort of some food and health issues mm-hmm. then, but with all of their... you can see why at a certain point after Mayor Duncan became mayor, I went to him and I said, let's talk about how we can do this together. Of course, he was already thinking about this, and we looked into some systems, and that's how we finally led to the collective impact model mm-hmm. as just a way of addressing issues that are way too complex for the school system to handle, for the businesses to handle, for the churches, for for government. We've got to, or the foundations, everybody can have, though, a piece of the overall action if we're coordinating our work in a way where we put our resources where we're going to have the biggest impact.
So if it's not the school system or a business, who is the entity that would be, you know, reaching out to a family, say, you know, to provide guidance to make sure that they have, you know, an adequate food supply, to make sure that the child is, you know, on their way to being ready into kindergarten.
Well, that's where all of the different entities come together to understand what's needed and provide a piece of it. For example, this is just a small example, but Caritas now has a caseworker on staff rather than giving the food, which people desperately need. They also have a chance to talk to someone. Some of the churches are doing some of that kind of the work. First Baptist Church has a lift program where they can work with families. There's just no one silver bullet, but there's lots of silver buckshot, and that's the approach we're taking.
And one of the places that we visited early on was Greenville and Spartanburg, South Carolina, and we went into a boys' club, girls' club after school program that they had contracted with the United Way to deliver better students. And so it wasn't just about teaching the academic portion of that child's school year, but they could then take and do some formative work after school, not only provide child care for the students, but also provide a learning environment, socialization skills, that they could then document the success of that program through high school graduation. And it was a meaningful metric to us. So there was a collective impact strategy that was brought in through metrics, funded in a contract that delivered results. That was really, it kind of opened our eyes as to how we can start tying all these things together.
Mm-hmm. Next, I'd like to talk a little bit about how people get to work. That seems to be one of the, that was mentioned a few times as one of the particular things that are getting, things that gets in the way of workers, you know, finding employment that, or finding employment A, and B, finding employment that might pay them a better wage. I guess, right, you know, what's a good goal? What are we looking at? One thing that the Upjohn study mentioned was that there's a lot of employers, like large employers, factories on the outskirts of town, and a lot of lower wage worker or low income people on the insides of town, and they might not have reliable transportation to get there. Is that something that is under the purview of the city? Can the city try to ensure
that they get to work? Yes, one of the things that will be brought into our contracts with our economic development partners is this concept that we want to recruit businesses to areas that have this higher concentration of un- and underemployed workers. And that's tough. I mean, some of these places have not been in the path of development, but there's no sense just overlooking them and saying that we can't develop there. We've found that the city is much better served by infill development than continuing to expand the sprawl. It's tremendously expensive to expand or extend infrastructure, highways, water, sewer, out to the edges to keep growing the industrial base when we have plenty of opportunity in town. And Upjohn actually identified three tracts of land for potential targets. But then you talk about how do we get people to the jobs. We can't stop the growth of the industrial district. So how do we get people there that need those jobs? And we've just completed, or we're in the process of receiving the recommendations from a transit study that was primarily focused on downtown, but it looked at how we tie downtown and the greater Waco area together. Bus rapid transit was the number one priority for that, which would cut down the headway now on a bus for somebody that lives in East Waco to get to the industrial district is over an hour each way. Mm-hmm. So with the advent of bus rapid transit, which is not, you know, it's going to be a significant investment, but we think there's outside funding to help. We could cut that down. There's one that they showed us yesterday in Springfield, Eugene, Oregon, that's got a 15-minute headway. Mm-hmm. So when you take and make it available at a very affordable rate for somebody to cross town in 15 minutes, public transit becomes a real viable option. So we're looking at that from a multi-prong approach.
And that plan was, having buses taking direct routes that go across town instead of coming into a central hub and then heading back to...
Yeah, everything now is based on every bus rider transfers, unless they're going within their neighborhood, they transfer at the transit center down on 8th and Mary.
Yeah.
And this would take, again, they used the word backbone when they started talking about it, but you would create a high traffic route. They mentioned Waco Drive, and go from one end of the urbanized area to the other on a very fast turnaround route, and then you have spurs that collect the neighborhoods off of that.
So there are two parts of that prong, I guess. One, developing areas in around low income neighborhoods that would have jobs,
right.
And the other is creating transportation to take people out to out to the jobs. If you could talk a little bit more about that first part, what kind of areas are you talking about in downtown Waco or in central Waco, near those low income areas?
Well, there are some really desirable places. The more the river develops, there are lots of available spots on Elm and on Garrison. We've got the old Pure Milk plant that's on Garrison on the other side of Waco Drive. They identified a large tract of land that's on Herring, and I believe it's Clifton Street. But it's a sizable piece, and it's close to existing industry. We've just always developed further out on the major highways, and this is going to use some arterial streets that have, there's significant development opportunities in those areas.
Yeah. How does a city encourage a business to make plans in one of those areas?
Well, we've got a partnership with the county that's the Waco-McLean County Economic Development Corporation, WebMAC, I think.
Yes.
And we contribute $1.5 million apiece, the county and the city, to this fund, and then we use that to incentivize businesses to locate. And so the city will be asking the county to take a look at helping us and incentivize those areas in the city limits.
Mm-hmm.
One of the primary focuses or one of the primary pieces of data that Upjohn delivered was the significant number of people that live in the city but don't work in the city.
Right.
And that's something that is one of our highest priorities, because that then will have a significant impact on the Waco Independent School District.
Mm-hmm.
As we've had all this this evaporation of people that will live out in the county and come into the city for jobs, mm-hmm. or live here and go outside for jobs. But the schools have all developed on the outsides of the WISD boundaries.
Mm-hmm. And by encouraging more people to live in Waco ISD,
the city and to have children in the WISD.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming in and chat with me. I'm Ryland Barton. I'm here with Mayor Malcolm Duncan and former Mayor Virginia Dupuy, and we've been talking about poverty and unemployment in Waco, and education and healthcare and a whole bunch of other things. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryland.
This interview with Waco Mayor Malcolm Duncan Jr. and former Mayor Virginia Dupuy is part of KWBU News' month-long series on poverty in Waco. Be sure to tune in next week. KWBU's Jill Ament will be talking with Waco ISD Superintendent Bonnie Kane, Indian Springs Middle School Principal John Jenkins, and J.H. Hines Elementary Principal Trey Hall.